today on Against the Grain. Did Ralph Waldo Emerson push a kind of radical individualism to the exclusion of collective consciousness and politics? Also, why did Joseph Levine move from Orthodox Judaism to atheism? I'm CS. You'll hear from English professor Eric Kinahan and from Levine, who teaches philosophy at UMass Amherst, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Religion, atheism, the individual, the collective, reading, writing, politics, and the Palestinians. These themes come to the fore in today's program, featuring two conversations, one about Ralph Waldo Emerson and the other about one man's journey from Orthodox Judaism to atheism. Eric Kinahan, who teaches English at the University at Albany, joined me to talk about his reading of Emerson, a 19th century thinker perhaps best known for his essay, Self-Reliance. Although later this hour, you'll hear Kinahan push back against the conventional notion that Emerson advanced a kind of radical individualism. We begin the hour with Joseph Levine, who was raised as an Orthodox Jew and then turned to atheism for reasons having to do with his questioning of key religious tenets and with the plight of the Palestinians. Levine is professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. He recounted his path from religion to atheism in the 2010 volume Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. When Joseph Levine joined me shortly after that book came out, I asked him to explain what he meant when he writes that his parents, and he himself, were raised in Torah Jewish homes.
I use the term, and I don't know how standard it is for everybody. Most people would have said Orthodox. So when you normally think of Orthodox Judaism, that's what I'm meant by Torah Judaism. The only reason I didn't want to use the word Orthodox is that nowadays that covers a wider variety of positions or lifestyles than I wanted to get at. So what I think is essential when I say a Torah Jew, what I think of as essential to that is one, that one really believes in the principal doctrines that there is a God who created the world in 6 days and has a special role for the Jewish people. One is a fairly strict observer of the Sabbath and a fairly strict observer of the dietary laws. Those are kind of the essential elements of what I think of as a Torah Jew.
And you believe the word fundamentalist is properly applied to Torah Jews. Might be obvious to some listeners, but how so?
Well, so for instance, when I was growing up, what I was taught in the yeshivas, which are the Jewish parochial schools, was that God indeed created the world in 6 days, that the world has been in existence for only 5,700 and some number of years, and that the entire five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, was dictated by God to Moses word for word. Things of that sort. Now, the only thing to be careful about is fundamentalism doesn't mean that you necessarily take what was said in the five books of Moses or even in the prophets literally, because you have to see how the Talmud interpreted it. But if you take the Torah as a package deal with what was called the written law covers the Pentateuch, the prophets, and the writings, things like the Book of Esther and Song of Songs and those things that are part of the standard Hebrew Bible. If you take that together with the Talmud, that package you're supposed to believe is, you know, literally true. But the Talmud, of course, gives you interpretations. You are not supposed to, on your own, interpret the Hebrew Bible itself.
And the Pentateuch is the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, correct?
Right.
Okay. What kinds of practices do Torah Jews, and therefore you when you were young, follow?
Well, so here are the main elements. the Sabbath, of course, is very important. Basically, from sundown Friday until about an hour after sundown on Saturday, you keep the Sabbath. And what that means is you don't do anything having to do with lighting or fire, and fire is interpreted to mean electricity, too, so there's no turning on, turning off lights. You can't drive a car. You can't write anything down. You can't cook. You can't even carry anything in your pockets outside of the bounds of your property. So there's that. There's keeping the Sabbath, going to synagogue both in the Friday night and Saturday morning. Another important aspect of it are, as I said, the dietary laws. So you can only eat meat that's been slaughtered according to the ritual slaughtering dictates. You can't eat milk and meat together, so you have to have two separate sets of dishes in your house for meat and for dairy. If you're a man, now there are different requirements for men and women. Men have many heavier requirements. You pray three times a day. And then one of the most interesting requirements that I talk about in the article is, again, only a requirement on men, not on women, is to study the Torah, which in practice mostly means studying Talmud. And that's actually a large part of a Torah Jew's life. Now, when you're young, you do that a lot. When you grow up, and unless you continue on in rabbinical school and make that your living, of course you have to work, so you can't do it as much. But many serious Torah Jews who have, you know, careers and the like do try to find some time during the day or week where they can spend some time doing what they call learning, which means studying Talmud or something of the sort.
You mentioned yeshivas. Do Torah Jews send their children to public school?
Not usually. It's avoided if at all possible.
You were sent to yeshiva, and then you left the school in 1966 to attend public school for the last 2 years of high school. What was that like?
Well, it was a big decision, and it was both scary and exciting. I had, as you say, been in yeshiva since I was 3 years old. And I had been studying Talmud since I can't remember exactly when I started, but something like seven. But in my last couple of years, right before then, so that would have been something like eighth and ninth grade, we're talking about the middle of the 60s in California. And I'm living, in fact, in an area of Los Angeles in the northern part of the San Fernando Valley where there was not a large concentration of Torah Jews. And, in fact, the yeshiva that my parents sent me to was a good hour drive from my house. So I started picking up influences of what was going on around me, and I got very curious, and I started to agitate with my parents to say, I want to see what public school is like. I want to try out this other culture. And I never have figured out why my parents said okay to that. But they did. So I went, and of course, at first I was somewhat intimidated. I was also, I should say, younger than most kids in my grade. And now I was going into a school where there were girls and boys in the same classes. That hadn't happened to me before. So in some respects, it was extremely intimidating. And the interesting part of it was, I think partly because, you know, I was kind of smart. I was an A student, and I was a little weird. I immediately gravitated toward the emerging hippie culture in the school. As I say, it's the 66 in Los Angeles, and it was still a minority part of the school, but it seemed the most welcoming.
Welcoming to smart kids?
Yeah, it wasn't a bad thing to be an A student, even though not everyone was into it. And I don't know, they were just more welcoming and tolerant, and they themselves felt like a minority that was looked down on by, as it were, the jocks and the like. So I kind of found them, and I have to say my my first semester, I had an English teacher who I am still very friendly with to this day, by the way. And she became a kind of den mother for the hippies in the school. So I kind of got in her orbit. And a lot of these students who were good at English and some of them who were into drama were the kids I started hanging out with. And that's where I sort of got introduced to the 60s culture. And I found it just, I mean, I took to it like a fish to water. To me, it was the most wonderful thing I had ever encountered.
And was that partly because you felt a kind of liberation from some of the rituals and restrictions you had experienced?
It was partly that. But it was also that it was an alternative. I mean, as I say, a number of these other kids were very smart. They were also into books. They weren't always into school and doing well, but they were into books. They were into talking about things. And I began to see an alternative way to intellectual fulfillment that was not as restrictive as the Torah way was. And that was very exciting, and especially a number of the teachers who were themselves were very progressive and very influenced by burgeoning 60s culture. I just started to get models for how you could get fulfillment both in a communal way, and I mean, as you know, friendship and closeness, and also intellectually and ethically. And it presented a real alternative, and I hadn't really known that was out there before.
When you graduated from high school, did you go straight to college?
No. What happened was, again, I was only 16 when I graduated, so I felt like I ought to take off a little bit of time. And then, I have to say, I had never really broke with the Torah tradition, and I decided that I would try to give it another chance. And so I actually threw myself rather wholeheartedly into studying in yeshiva again. There was a rabbi who I had studied with when I was very young who had a yeshiva that not only catered to kids in K through 12, but also was a place that people who were post-high school could actually spend the entire day there. And I went to study in his yeshiva, and then I kind of threw myself totally into it and ended up studying in his school for about a year and a half, and then he sent me off to Jerusalem, where I studied for another year and a half. And so I spent about three and a half years totally reimmersing myself in that life. Until at one point, rather dramatically, I decided that this was not for me, and that was the real break that happened.
That's the voice of Joseph Levine. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and his article, From Yeshiva Bochar to Secular Humanist, is part of a new volume entitled Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life, edited by Louise Antony and published by Oxford University Press. Okay, Joe, so you tantalized us before that reintroduction. What happened such that you broke, I imagine, emotionally and spiritually with the Torah Jew tradition?
I can theorize about it now. And we're talking, I was 19, so it's close to 40 years ago. But basically what happened was there was a lot of self-deceiving of myself when I threw myself back into it. I never could really shake the feeling this isn't for me. I couldn't really believe it all, even though I kept telling myself I did. And then, actually, I started having some psychological symptoms while I was in Israel that, you know, were never really officially diagnosed, but I would say it was something like panic attacks. I would all of a sudden start having what looked like hallucinations and anxiety. I guess anxiety attacks is a better term. And these just started coming a little more frequently. And I remember actually going to see some Orthodox Jewish, psychotherapists that were recommended to me by the people at the yeshiva I was at there. And I just realized it wasn't helping. And I just came to realization one day, you know what? I don't believe this, and I actually don't want this anymore.
So you decided to leave the yeshiva in Jerusalem. You attended UCLA. And I guess maybe this is a good point to get into your discussion in this article of three key ideas of Torah Jewish life: transcendence, community, and Aristotelian flourishing. Let's take them in turn. What do you mean by transcendence?
What I had in mind is the idea that the easiest example is, suppose a traditional Judeo-Christian God exists. So this is an entity who has a will, has a purpose, is all-encompassing, is the most fundamental, most important entity there is at the foundation of everything that goes on in the entire universe. Well, the idea is that here we are, you know, if you think of us physically, we occupy this very small portion of this very small planet and this small galaxy, right, in this vast universe. And the idea that what we do is connected to this entity that I just described, God, is a way of saying that we are part of what is most significant about the universe. It transcends our own existence in a certain way. And, you know, it's hard not to find that a very powerful idea in one's life. And it certainly makes it easy to see how to connecting to that gives you an automatic source of meaning for your life, an automatic source of direction, and an automatic sense of your significance.
The second idea is community. What do you mean by community in the context of this discussion of Torah Judaism?
Well, a very important aspect of Torah Judaism that I don't know if it's the same in other religions or not is the idea of the Jewish people as a significant entity in its own right. I mean, there's God, and then there's what you're supposed to do, but then there's this entity, the Jewish people. And your connection with them, your being a part of them, is of paramount significance. And you're supposed to live your life in a way where you're not just thinking about your relation to God, but you're thinking about your relation to the people. Other Jews matter in a way that no one else can matter to you. It's like the feeling you have with that people might have for their own individual nuclear family, and that there's a special role for the people in God's plan for history. And as I described in the article, when I was religious, I believed this. I bought into this idea. On the other hand, it was in many ways the least compelling to me at an emotional level. I never could quite feel like, yes, I care about what happens to other Jews more than I care about what happens to anybody else. I mean, I could get the idea that I could care about what happens to my brother and my mother and my father more, say, than other people. That made sense to me. But this idea that somehow by virtue of being Jewish, someone living, you know, on the other side of the world had a closer connection to me than my non-Jewish neighbor down the street, always it was something that I didn't have a visceral feeling for. It's sort of an intellectual idea that it was an obligation to feel that way. But and I think it's kind of what made it easier for me to break with Torah Judaism than it is for other people.
And we're going to get more into what community means and the idea of the chosen people and your approach toward that idea in just a little bit. The third key idea of Torah Jewish life that you identify is Aristotelian flourishing. What is that?
What I have in mind here is, and this is a familiar idea in philosophy that does connect with Aristotle, but not only Aristotle. And so this is a oversimplified, unscholarly take on Aristotle, but basically the idea is, Aristotle's idea was that each kind of creature has certain capabilities that are distinctive to that creature. And what's best, what counts as the best thing, the most, the way that that kind of creature can flourish is when it develops those capacities that are distinctive of its kind. So, you know, swimming for a fish might be the kind of thing. You know, running for a cheetah or something like that. So what is it for human beings? Well, it's our rational faculty. That's what is, of course, distinctive of human beings over all other animals. And it, by rational, I don't mean just intellectual, artistic, craft. You know, the kind of thing that humans can do that other animals don't do. The kind of creative efforts that are involve our mental capacities. And to flourish in this way is to devote oneself to activities that develop these distinctive capacities to their, you know, highest level possible.
And what activities might that mean for a Torah Jew? What activities would lead to Aristotelian flourishing?
Well, in particular, what I had in mind from my life in yeshiva was the study of Torah. So in that case, I had in mind specifically a very somewhat academic intellectual model. And so it was the developing of the intellectual capacities that Talmud study in particular really brings out, because you really fine-tune your ability to distinguish among subtle differences in concepts, to follow arguments. And I really enjoyed the fact that it was considered a kind of religious devotion to do this.
That's Joe Levine. He teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. There's also the issue of Torah Judaism's emphasis on the Jews being God's chosen people, that they are God's agents in the world. You write that Torah Jews carry out this mission as God's agents via Torah study. What objections did you develop, do you have, toward the idea that the Jews are God's chosen people?
Well, I just, in the end, found that ethically intolerable. And it always bothered me, even when I was a believer. It seemed to me that there is just a certain kind of chauvinism involved. First of all, attributing to God the idea that he would pick one people and treat them differently, provide for them opportunities for both spiritual development and reward that were different from everybody else, just seemed, frankly, unfair. I didn't know how a just God could do that. And then I also began to see, just in my own community, I mean, so one thing is just on the level of doctrine. Does this seem like an ethical doctrine? It did not seem like an ethical doctrine to me. This became more and more apparent as I began to doubt more and more, and it certainly fed those doubts. But then, you know, I might have said, well, there are lots of beliefs that people have that on their own may not seem right, but who cares? But I began to see some real effects of this, and I began to notice a real sense of genuine chauvinism, I guess is the best word, where what mattered to people was what happened to Jews, and it just didn't matter as much what happened to other people.
I'm imagining you're referring here in part to your experiences living in Israel, observing how Arabs and specifically Palestinians were treated by the Israeli Jews. What kind of impressions did this have on you?
Well, it's funny. As you know, when I went to Israel, I had, as I talked about earlier, I had had those couple of years in high school where I was very immersed in this 60s culture, and a large part of that was the political culture of the 60s, and I, you know, had become an ardent opponent of the Vietnam War. I mean, young as I was, I wasn't able to act on it that much, but I certainly identified with the protesters. And then I got put into this environment where all of a sudden things were different. But somehow I still thought, you know, Israel was a separate case. Somehow the Jews, had a right to be in Israel and to create that state. And when I went there, I only at a sort of subconscious level started to feel more and more uneasy as I lived there and started to see the ways in which both Israeli Palestinians who were, you know, had Israeli citizenship, but then also the Palestinians of the occupied territories were treated in this second, third, fourth class, whatever you want to call it, way. And it didn't rise to consciousness right away. And especially when I first got there, there was a tremendous amount of military tension happening. I got there in January of 70. And at the time, this is 3 years, 2.5 years after the Six-Day War. And what was going on was what was called at the time the War of Attrition. And there were daily shellings and airplane raids back and forth between Egypt and Israel. And so because there was this sense of, you know, the state's in danger, I don't now believe it was really in danger, but certainly that sense was cultivated. I kind of suppressed feelings at the time of worrying about how the Arabs were treated. But it kept bothering me. And by the time I left, and especially after I was in college for a couple of years and started to read Chomsky, I started to reflect back on my own experience, and I realized, oh, I see. Yeah, this is really, really bad. And in fact, this is oppression of a piece with all the other kinds of oppression that I'd been opposed to. And when I would try to talk about this with people within the Jewish community, I just realized, no, this was a no-no. You can't go there. And the main reason was that it was just this, it's us against them, and we are special. We have the right to do things because we are God's people. Not everybody would use that terminology, but I felt it infected the climate. So even non-religious Jews who might not use explicitly the justification that we are God's people, somehow they are acting out of that kind of motivation. And it really repelled me.
Now, another person you read in college was Nietzsche, the fiery philosopher. You write that you took from your early reading of Nietzsche that belief in God might be not just be wrong, but might be morally wrong, that belief in God might be morally wrong. How so?
Well, and again, for any Nietzsche scholars out there, I hesitate to say I am far from a Nietzsche scholar. But so when I went back to UCLA and I majored in philosophy, and for a while, even though I had kind of shed most of my practices, you know, I stopped keeping kosher, stopped keeping the Sabbath and the like, but I kind of held on the fence about whether I really believed in God for a while. And I remember taking this class on existentialism, and we read some Nietzsche. And then I had a lot of conversations with a graduate student who was a TA for one of my classes, and I used to just hang out with him a lot and discuss this. And the idea came to me that there isn't a conservative strategy. That is, you might think, well, what's the harm of thinking there's a God? You know, can't hurt, and it could be bad to be an atheist if there really is a God. So why not take the safe route and believe in him, if you can choose to believe, that is. And then all of a sudden I started to realize, well, no, Nietzsche had a challenge. Nietzsche said there's something about this kind of belief structure that's associated with Judeo-Christian belief in God that is really anti-humanistic, and therefore it's really wrong. It really inverts, it takes everything that is, you know, that Aristotelian flourishing I talked about, it is distinctively human, that it's human contribution, and it downplays that and instead projects it onto this non-existent entity and, as it were, gives it all the credit, and that there's something wrong with doing that. it's a kind of crime against ourselves, and that a morally superior attitude would be to both take credit and blame for ourselves and not project that onto non-existent unseen forces that are, you know, out there in the universe like God and the devil.
Later in the interview, I asked Joe Levine to talk more about what one gains when one leaves God behind.
What's at least exhilarating, I think, is this thing that is the flip side of what I was talking about Nietzsche earlier, is that once one abandons the belief in God and realizes that it's all on us, the good things that happen and the bad things, it's all on us, then I feel that it gives us, rather than losing any meaning in our lives, it gives us the sense that we create the meaning in our lives, and it gives us a purpose because there's no one else to rely on. It really is up to us to make something of this world. The world itself is impersonal. The meaning is to be found from what we make of it. And I think that that's a heady and sometimes dizzying kind of thought. But in the end, I think it's an uplifting one.
Joseph Levine, professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I spoke with him about his article, From Yeshiva Bohar to Secular Humanist, which I came across in the volume Philosophers Without Gods, Meditations on Atheism and the Secular Life. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the 19th century essayist and philosopher who, according to most accounts, championed individualism and independent thinking. Eric Kinahan, an associate professor of English at the University at Albany, took on the conventional notion that Emerson pushed a kind of radical individualism in an essay he contributed to The Other Emerson, a volume edited by Branka Arsic and Carrie Wolfe. Kinahan, who wanted me to make clear that he was not an Emerson specialist when we spoke in August 2012, began with these reflections on Emerson's work.
Emerson has been historically very often misread as being just a proponent of or a supporter of what he terms self-reliance, this idea of nonconformity and sort of a radical kind of individualism, which is very often what his thinking and writing is celebrated for. And yet, for Emerson, individualism, that sense of individualism, is just a starting point. At least in my Emerson, and sort of my reading of Emerson, it's a way of reconnecting back to larger collectives and commonalities. You know, there's a tension that exists in his writing and in his philosophy, that tension between the role of the individual and the role of the collective. And so he's seeking a kind of health between both. To have a healthy collective, one must have a healthy individual. And yet, that individual health can't overshadow the collective.
Emerson, in his writings, repeatedly used the term the common. What does he mean by the common?
Well, one of the things that I explore in the essay is how, when he begins invoking this term, the common, he's really talking about the everyday, the quotidian, sort of the banalities of everyday life. There's this fantastic passage early on in The American Scholar, one of his early speeches, where he writes about, and I'll just quote from Emerson himself, the meal in the firkin, the milk in the pan, the ballad in the street, the news of the boat, the glance of the eye, the form and the gait of the body. And all these common things, like the everyday things of life, of what's, you know, cooking on the stove and what we might hear, the music of the street or what's going on amongst sailors or shipmen, what we see in sort of exchanges with other people's glances, that is all a way of reconnecting us with what is human. So very much what is common for Emerson, and even what we mean is sort of the day-to-day sense, the colloquial sense of the term, of like commonalities, or common sense things, is a way to connect us to one another, to a new kind of community, you might say.
It's interesting because he's both talking about the particular, right? The banal, the everyday, the near. I'm reading now from other ways of describing the common, the near, the most particular, the base. And yet he's also talking about the universal, right? I guess because this is all something we share.
Absolutely. Emerson is often thought of as being preoccupied with the metaphysical, the spiritual, you know, his term of the transcendental. But in order to access that sense of what is universal and common to all of humanity, he believed very firmly that one must begin with the particular, as you had nicely put it, C.S. That sense of what is base, what is common, what is that which we experience every day, because that is the root of experience, but to not be stuck in it. You know, part of what we need to do is to process it and to sort of find a meaning in the common, not to overwrite it, but to find some way in which it can push us to a different way of understanding how we might reconnect with others or how we might reorient ourselves to our own sense of who we are as individuals and as a people.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, the, you know, very famous essayist, among other things, in his essay, History, what did he say about the one mind common to all individual men?
So the sense of the one common mind. He wrote in History, there is one mind common to all individual men. Every man is an inlet to the same and to all of the same. He that is once admitted to the right of reason is made a freeman of the whole estate. So for Emerson, a lot of his investment in this idea of transcendentalism and the sense of sort of universality is a different access to a kind of rationality, sort of a common rationality that would be all-inclusive for all people. I mean, one of the mystiques of democracy is that it is a democratic form, but very often how democratic institutions function is in such a way that not everyone has access to that kind of rational thinking or has access to those things that allow for the development of a kind of rationalized engagement. And so one of the things that Emerson is invested in as a thinker and philosopher is thinking about a different sort of standard for rationality. And for him, that standard is very much a natural reason. And this is where he's very Jeffersonian, that sense of a sort of natural rights and an inalienable rights, the sense of a kind of humanist foundation for all manner of thought, that every individual has access to this natural reason that can actually allow one to sort of reconnect to all of humanity in a way that is not exclusivist or excluding of others.
When you talk, Eric, about individual rights, a lot of people would think of liberalism, right? Not as in terms of liberal and conservative, but sort of the liberal tradition, the liberalist ethos in the democratic tradition. Can you talk about liberalism and can you talk about, because Emerson apparently adopted a fairly consistent stance toward liberalism, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He never used the term liberalism, at least that I know of. This is really a term that I, for one, am sort of bringing back into my assessment of Emerson. I've been thinking through this idea of, as you said, a liberalist ethos as a kind of formal feature of democratic institutions and democratic ideologies. And when I use the term liberalism, I'm thinking about the ways in which, especially in modernity, and the ways in which democracy is configured as a modern ideology, a modern belief and political structure, there is an aggrandizement of the individual to such an extent that the individual risks becoming what is called atomized, just sort of an atom floating among other atoms. And Emerson, as we had talked a little bit about at the beginning of our conversation, was very critical of that understanding of a kind of atomized ethos, sort of this radical individualism where one is utterly cut off from others. The danger of that understanding of individualism is that it gives a false sense of what we might call sovereignty, sort of the all-powerful, omnipotent nature of the individual. And when you start thinking in terms of individuals who have, you know, this misbelief that they are all-powerful, then we have a society in which individuals risk sort of butting up against one another, not communicating, not actually establishing any sort of common ground. And so Emerson was very much interested in a way of creating a very tenuous balancing act between the individual and this sense of commonality or community, finding a way in which they might speak to one another. But liberalism itself as a kind of politicized ethos disallows that kind of tenuous balance because it tends to over-exaggerate the significance of the individual in the mix.
His name is Eric Keenahan, K-E-E-N-A-G-H-A-N. He teaches English at the University at Albany, State University of New York, and we are talking about an essay, a chapter he contributed to a volume called The Other Emerson, edited by Branka Arsic and Carrie Wolf and published by University of Minnesota Press. And my name is C.S. Song. Let's talk about reading. The activity of reading, creative reading, I guess, is what Emerson called it. What is commonality? Okay, so we've been talking about the common, about the familiar, the banal. What does commonality have to do with the activity of reading?
Well, commonality is perhaps we might think of it as sort of the end product of reading, of sort of what one hopes to attain through this very common and commonplace activity that many of us engage in. Part of what's interesting about Emerson when he's writing in the 19th century is that he perhaps tends to heroize reading a little bit more than we might be apt to today. And what I mean by that is he doesn't really acknowledge the fact that not everyone is able to read, which is an especially important fact when we're thinking about the antebellum period and that slaves were living in a period of enforced illiteracy. But for Emerson, he saw reading very much as having a democratic potential, that it is ostensibly an activity that everyone can engage in. And if everyone can engage in this mode of reading, then if they're reading correctly, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, then they are better able to produce or contribute to that sense of a commonality that he was striving after.
Yeah, and what would be sort of a correct kind of reading?
Well, it is that phrase that you refer to of creative reading, which is a phrase he introduces in The American Scholar. And when Emerson talks about creative reading, he's really asking us to read in such a way that we allow ourselves to surrender to the text. In English studies, which is my discipline, this isn't an uncommon idea at all. The idea that we perform what in English studies we call close reading, that we pay particular attention to the words on the page and the words direct us to a particular kind of understanding of the text or direct us to a different way of thinking and different way of conceptualizing our relationship to particular issues that might be treated or raised by a text. But for most readers, most modern readers, that idea of close reading or what Emerson called creative reading is actually quite foreign. That one gives oneself over so thoroughly to a text that one actually might risk something in the process of reading.
Right, and here maybe we get to the title of your essay, the last few words are "An Ethics of Risk." So in what ways is reading a risky endeavor?
Well, reading is a risky endeavor because we are introduced to ideas that are not our own, or to language that is not our own. And yet when we're reading, and if we are engaged in this mode of creative reading, we're engaged in such a way that we feel something for it. You know, there's in a lot of contemporary theory, there is this strand of thinking called affect theory, about the ways in which either material objects, or sometimes language, or others actually affect us, have this visceral effect upon us that are seductive or luring. And one thing that comes about in affect theory is a development of idea that if we are lured by something that is not ourselves, whether it's an idea or an object or a person, that lure is both seductive and so therefore has those connotations of pleasure, but it's also disruptive of who we think we are, of what we seem to know about ourselves or about our world. And so for Emerson, his idea of creative reading is very much a kind of seduction, where we're seduced by others' ideas, others' language, and that seduction is a kind of experience. And as with all forms of experience for Emerson, it's potentially disorienting, disruptive. It changes who we think we are. And that transformation is very important.
And what is this process of disorientation and maybe, I don't know, losing ourselves as we read? What does that process have to do with commonality? Because it sounds to me like you're speaking more about a very individual, solitary activity where, you know, for example, if I'm reading, I'm sort of coming to terms more with myself as opposed to I'm necessarily establishing connections, say, across borders, across boundaries with other people.
That's a fantastic question. The activity itself is, on the one hand, solitary. I mean, Emerson, throughout his essays, recurrently goes back to this image of someone sort of retreating to a study, you know, retreating to a study to read, retreating to a study to engage in this activity of othering oneself, to do exactly as you said, to come into a different kind of relationship to oneself with who one thinks one is. And yet at the same time, if we think about it a little bit abstractly, even in reading, we're not alone. You can be sitting alone in a study, but if you're giving yourself over to what's on the page, if you're giving yourself over to someone else's ideas, then part of what you're doing is engaging in a different kind of relation. You become dependent on the page. You become dependent on that language. You become dependent on the author, on her ideas. And that kind of dependence is a different way of thinking about how two subjects, two persons, might interact with one another. This is what is disruptive of what we have been talking about earlier in terms of that liberalist ethos, where there's that sense of the sovereign individual who's all powerful. But if in reading you learn how to give yourself over to others and their ideas, to their words, then you're actually giving up some of your claims to that sense of sovereignty. So we might think of reading as kind of an exercise, a preparation for a different kind of interaction.
And here we get back to the common, right? Commonality, threads and kind of lineages of ideas and modes of expression that flow through us and that maybe we contribute to in our own specific way, but that can't be seen as just original and originating from nowhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the shames of sort of a misunderstanding of Emerson's idea of self-reliance is just this misunderstanding that the individual can be the originator of their own thought. You know, but this is where Emerson is a complicated figure, and sort of his thinking has a little bit of ambivalence to it that we need to take into account. You know, all originality is never original. You know, it depends on good reading. It depends on really listening. It depends on trying to articulate more and more clearly the truth of things as one interprets that truth of things. But the great thing, and this is what I always tell my students too, is that readers, poets, philosophers, all of us, you know, we always fail. We never quite say what we mean to say. We never quite articulate that truth as we see it. You know, there's something elusive about it. And so part of what we just need to do, and this is the core of Emerson's thought, is really to just continually try to articulate it. And when it is a potentially political idea such as the common, you know, there's this way in which we might think about Emerson as a romantic thinker, you know, sort of an idealism that has no place in modern society. At the same time, you know, there's this sense, this hypersensitivity in his work, at least in my reading of his work, to the sense that that ideal can never be attained, that we always have to keep working for and striving for and trying to articulate that ideal. And that rearticulation reconnects us to the past and also pushes us forward to the future. And it gives us, you know, quite bluntly, gives us a reason to keep on living.
Eric Keenahan, Associate Professor of English at the University at Albany. You can find his essay about Emerson in the volume The Other Emerson, published by the University of Minnesota Press.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.